This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Affordable Care Act isn't the only signature policy of the Obama era facing an uncertain future. Net neutrality is another. Donald Trump's FCC is looking into rolling back regulations that guarantee open, equal access to the Internet. And we talked to experts about what that might mean for you as a consumer. But first, NASCAR. The sport that was born and raised in Charlotte is also facing an uncertain future. Declining attendance, falling TV ratings, and the loss of popular drivers are all combining to put a caution flag out for the future of the sport. Jeff Gordon is gone, Tony Stewart is too, and recently NASCAR's biggest star, Dale Earnhardt Jr., announced his impending retirement. But he has a different take on what's going on. Dale is actually optimistic.
In my history of being around the sport, there's kind of always been these little gaps in between everything that cycles, whether it's fashion or drivers or cars or whatever. It never really is a seamless transition from one to the next. But I'm thrilled. I mean, we definitely have tons of talent. There's no question. The sky's the limit for NASCAR. I'm super excited about the future.
And NASCAR is working to steer out of the skid, too. That's important to the drivers, to fans, and to Charlotte, where NASCAR employs lots of people and where fans spend millions of tourism dollars. So what does the future look like? Let's ask some people in the know. Woody Kane is the radio news director for the Motor Racing Network and the host of NASCAR Today. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nat Ryan is here, too. He's a NASCAR reporter for NBC Sports and a veteran of auto racing reporting all over the East. Welcome.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here. It's actually Nate.
Nate, what did I say?
Nat. But well, there I get that a lot. I get confused with small insects quite frequently.
Well, thank you, Ant. Nice to have you here. And that's an anagram, isn't it?
Yeah, there you go.
For a while, and I'm not certain for how long, it seemed like NASCAR was exploding. I mean, tracks were being developed. The TV contracts were all over the place. Major networks started picking up these races. Began to shed its old image and adopt a new one. It was becoming the sport of yuppies, for lack of a better term. Drivers were also changing from that hard scrabble, old good old boy attitude to people like Jeff Gordon, who were, for lack of a better term, pretty boys, I suppose, more sophisticated guys. Now this thing seems to be slowing down. What happened?
I think it's something that you're seeing across all sports. I mean, when was the last time we could say the NFL was down, for example? I think there's so much competition, so many different ways to consume whatever entertainment you're interested in, that it's gotten more fragmented, and the sport is trying to adjust to that, as are other sports and forms of entertainment.
But NASCAR fans, at least from an outsider's point of view, they seem to be rabid. I mean, when they loved or hated somebody, they loved or hated them, and they wanted to be part of it.
Well, the man that they loved and hated the most, I think, yeah, Mike, was Dale Earnhardt. And I think what we've seen over the last 10 years is a bubble popping a little bit that was created by the death, unfortunately, of Dale Earnhardt in the 2001 Daytona 500. He was the sport's John Wayne. It's Elvis. He was truly iconic. He was transcendent. And the reason people loved him is some people cheered for him, some people hated him, but everybody was watching. And I think there were a lot of casual fans that came in after his death for a few years, tried out NASCAR, and they went away.
What was that about, and why has nothing or no one stepped in to take his place as effectively as he took his place?
I think because it's the definition of being a generational star. I mean, you only get them once per generation. I think that, as Dale Earnhardt Jr. said, and who would know but the son of the seven-time champion Intimidator, there will be another star to come, but I think that it is truly that much of a transcendent superstar-level person, but I think that there's often some gaps. I feel like NASCAR right now is very much where the NBA was in 1999, after Michael Jordan's second retirement. It took a little time for the NBA to find who those next people would be that would carry the flag. And I think if you look 18 months after Michael Jordan's retirement, you had Shaq and Kobe winning their first championship, and that took the NBA into its next era. And I think that's key. NASCAR has a cadre of young stars it's trying to promote and push, but they need to do well, Woody.
Yeah. They have to win. They have to win because everybody wants to get on the bandwagon when somebody's winning. And you've got a host of compelling young stars coming up through the sport. But like Dale Jr. said, there is that gap. And it doesn't seem like, I know it is, Nate, but it doesn't seem like all that long ago that Dale Jr. was the kid with the bleached hair, the bleached goatee, and the hat backwards. And there was kind of a double take moment. Now he's the veteran and in that same press conference you played the clip from, he went on to talk about how these young up-and-coming drivers are so much more savvy on the social media side than he ever had to be. But if you recall, when he got on to Twitter, there was this buzz, and he had, like, what, a million followers in just a day or two? It just went, and he was at the forefront of it. And Brad Keselowski did the same thing when he took a picture of the fire on the backstretch when Juan Pablo Montoya ran into the jet dryer at Daytona, and his Twitter account went, pow. They're learning how to do that, and these younger guys are already like kids come up knowing seemingly at birth how to use technology, right. And the rest of us have to learn it. These guys know it.
Is that helping? Is Twitter helping? Because it seems to me that one of the things that NASCAR fans like is this connection they have with their driver or the team that surrounds the driver, and Twitter allows them to be in on the inner workings of this, like they're standing right next to these people. Is that helping?
I think it helps, Mike, but I think there's also a downside. I think that it can create a narrative where everybody feels like they are part of the conversation, which is great. As you mentioned, one of the strongest appeals of NASCAR and its drivers is that they've always been accessible. They're the guys who sign autographs. Richard Petty has probably signed 10 million autographs, maybe not an exaggeration in his career. But the Twitter age has taken this to a level where everybody has an opinion on everything.
Yes, and it's equally valid.
Yes, and yeah. And NASCAR has, to its credit, really taken on this push to cater to its fan base because they realize that there has been a retrenchment and audience growth here, and they want to do what they can to rebuild it. So they're listening to their fans. I think sometimes you can listen to too many opinions at the same time, and they're too discordant, and it's hard to form a consensus on the way forward.
But, you know, when you talk about that dynamic, I agree. Back in the era when Richard Petty would sign every autograph, you're talking hundreds of people around him. Now, as tracks try to find more ways to entice fans to buy tickets, they're giving them more access to the garage and pit mm-hmm. area than ever before. Now it's thousands of people. And Dale Jr. went through, you probably saw a thing on Twitter where he was traveling somewhere and answering questions, and people were asking, why don't you sign this autograph or that autograph? And he goes, well, if you sign one, 10 leave upset because you didn't sign right. there. So I prioritize with kids, that type of thing.
Right. During the recession, attendance at all sporting events, but particularly I think at NASCAR, began to fall because people didn't have the expendable income, and the recession pretty much hit a lot of people very hard, particularly in the middle class. And even though we've gone through this recovery, it was clear in November that a lot of people have not recovered from this, and maybe their jobs aren't coming back. How many of those people are the fan base who can't afford to take a 4 or 5 or 6 hour trip and spend a weekend in a hotel around any racetrack in America?
I think the hotel thing is one that is buzzing a lot now among fans. I mean, I remember, was it last year, year before at Bristol, Mike Joy, the anchor for Fox, said that their crew was staying further away from Bristol than they ever had to get some kind of decent hotel prices. That's one thing that's going on, but there's more than just that one thing. TV, Nate is with NBC, TV is so good now that they can take you places you've never been before, things you can't see from your seat in the grandstands. I saw a release where there's some experimentation going on at like four tracks this year where they're going to put those cameras in the cars, like when you're shopping for a home and you can turn and look at the whole living room or the whole bedroom or wherever you are. They're going to put those in cars and let fans look at that from whatever view they want
in real
while
time.
The cars go. Yeah, that type of thing, the whole digital dash thing that they want fans to be able to see. All that is coming up now to where you can see more at home in many instances than you can at the track itself.
And I've done this, so I know this. But if you have a surround set up on your TV, I mean, it's amazing, the audio. And there's
right?
One of the networks, and I don't know which one it is, and I hope it's NBC, has at one point said, turn up the sound and listen. And they stop talking. And you just hear the cars going around you in a circle. I mean, it's pretty darned amazing.
I will take some credit here. Thanks, Woody. Although I have nothing to do with the TV production, I will tell you that like I don't think the TV coverage has ever been better, particularly on the NBC side of the schedule.
There
and I think that's true across all sports. I mean, the NFL is fighting this as well, where they don't have full stadiums, but they've had record ratings in the last couple of years because people find it easier just to sit on their couch and listen to high-def sound on their big plasma flat screens. But going back to your other point, Mike, I think NASCAR is more susceptible to a recession, or two, a situation like we find ourselves right now in America with wage gap discussions being so prevalent. I mean, NASCAR likes to talk about how there's been a change in their demographics and there are more doctors, bankers, and lawyers, but it's still primarily blue collar. And it's still primarily the people who love Dale Earnhardt because right. he represented that working man's image. And when they did have less disposable income after, you know, after the Great Recession of 2008, in some ways that's never come back. And I feel like in some ways tracks have not right-sized appropriately in terms of dropping ticket prices because, as you mentioned, Mike, a lot of fans drive 6 hours to go to a race. They spend hundreds of dollars on hotel rooms, and then they'll spend another $500 on four tickets for a race. And I think that tracks are finding that's a breaking point.
Yeah. You just said the working man's image.
Yes.
And a lot of the popular drivers, the younger drivers, and I don't mean the new crop mm-hmm. coming, I'm talking about the Jeff Gordon era and the Dale Earnhardt Jr. era. These guys were not working guys.
Right.
Has that played a role in it? These guys were different than their predecessors. And that was by design, I think. Wasn't that part of the NASCAR
yes.
push
mm-hmm.
to bring in new fans? Did that backfire in some way?
I don't think it backfired entirely because, as you mentioned, NASCAR wanted to get beyond the Southeast. So it was great to have a driver like Jeff Gordon, who was a touchstone to California
right.
and also has Indiana roots. He brought a whole swath of people in across the country who might never have watched NASCAR before. But I will say that there is no Dale Earnhardt. There is no Harry Gantt, who was a guy who used to win races on Sunday and roof houses on Monday.
In his 50s, win races.
Yeah, yeah. They're missing that. And Tony Stewart embodied that perhaps better than anybody, and he's gone. And Woody, I know you can speak to this, but like the young drivers that they're trying to promote now, they're millennials. They're different. They don't have the same values and ideals that baby boomer, even my generation, Gen X, can relate to. And I think that's where there's a tug of war there in trying to like maintain the fan base and build new ones.
And it might be pre-baby boomer.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
The petties and things like that.
Yeah.
I think that's pre-baby
yeah.
boomer. But Dale Earnhardt said just a moment ago that the sport has a lot of young, talented drivers out there. But is talent all there is to it, Woody?
No, certainly not. These days, it used to be you had to prove yourself through the lower divisions, the Truck Series, the Xfinity Series, and prove you weren't going to tear up a team owner's equipment and force them to build new cars every week before they would, for lack of a better phrase, hand you the keys to the cup car. Now, if you have talent, inklings of talent, somebody wants to snap you up and put you in a car now. That's the demographic the sponsors want. So it's not just the talent. It's also, can you bring sponsorship? Can you attract the financial support that's gonna support this business and support building all these race cars and the hundreds of people that these teams have building and engineering these cars now? It's a double-edged sword now. It's more than just talent.
And NASCAR's chief marketing officer, Jill Gregory, says that the sport has realized that it needs to take a more active role in helping create the stars of tomorrow. Can you create a star? Doesn't that depend on the driver himself or herself in and his team? I mean, isn't
yeah,
that...
It has to be authentic, Mike. And I do a podcast for NBC, NASCAR NBC podcast, and I had Jill on there last October, and we talked a lot about this new generation that they're trying to promote, which is Chase Elliott, Ryan Blaney, Kyle Larson, Eric Jones, Austin Dillon, Joey Logano, a lot of guys who are 26 and younger. Of that list, only Joey Logano has truly had a lot of success.
Of that list of names, he's the one I've heard.
The combined win total of the other guys on that list is one, and that's by by Kyle Larson.
Yeah.
So I think that's Jill conceded that when I talked to her, that like they need these guys to win. They know who they want the next generation of stars to be, but they need some legitimacy and validation if they win.
But the difference is with racing, it's not like a stick and ball sport. Any parent practically can get a football or a baseball or something like that. Go buy a car. There's no youth leagues for racing out there. They're very expensive, and it costs a lot of money to develop these stars.
Yeah, Jeff Gordon was lucky. His parents who supported him in that effort. Woody Kane is here from the Motor Racing Network and NASCAR today, and Nate Ryan from NBC Sports. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting Mahler's Symphony No. 2, performed by over 250 musicians with the Symphony Chorus that explores the full range of human emotion. May 12th and 13th at Belk Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And Novant Health Neuroscience is providing neurological care to partner with patients on their path to brain health. Information available at novanthealth.org/brainhealth. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Manager released increases his proposed budget with no increase in property taxes despite spending increases. Anti-toll road forces lose an appeal to halt construction. CMS works to explain their student assignment plan and address concerns of parents. And Duke Energy holds their annual meeting online, but real protesters show up anyway. We get into those stories and more with our roundtable of reporters tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, the U.S. is squandering a quarter of the money spent on health care every year, to the tune of $765 billion. We'll dig in. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the present and the future of NASCAR, which is very important to Charlotte because it creates lots of jobs and it brings in millions of dollars in tourist activity. Willie Kane is here, the radio news director of the Motor Racing Network and the host of NASCAR Today. Nate Ryan is a NASCAR reporter for NBC Sports. One of you, I think it was you, Nate, said just before the break that they know who they want, meaning NASCAR knows who they want to be the next stars. Is that how the previous stars became stars, because the organization knew who they wanted, or did they just organically emerge? And is that the way to do it, to pick talent and say, here's who we're foisting down your throats?
No, as Nate said, it has to be authentic. But back to his point about when Dale Earnhardt was killed at Daytona, his fans naturally gravitated to Dale Earnhardt Jr., the direct bloodline who was already racing. That was a natural type thing.
There is some resentment, I think, among current Sprint Cup drivers. Jill, again, during this podcast I did with her, conceded this, that like she had heard from a driver who said, hey, it's great you want to promote those guys, but maybe they could win some races before you put them out there so much. But I understand why NASCAR has to do it, Mike, because so much of things in 21st century America have become marketing driven and social media driven. You can't do it the way that they did in the 1960s and 70s. You can't just rely on a Darrell Waltrip or Cale Yarborough or whoever to emerge from relative obscurity and become a star.
This is happening in every single industry that I can think of, particularly in the entertainment industry, where things used to be organic and real.
Sure.
Where if you were a singer or an actor or you were a race car driver, you worked your way up from nothing and you struck it for whatever reason. And now everything seems to be manufactured with the bottom line in mind. Is that racing?
I think it is, in terms of if a driver still wins, he's going to have a fan base. And I think that, again, NASCAR has to do things differently than it did 40 or 50 years ago. They can't – I mean – their next generation of stars has to be reflective of society. And society, as you said, Mike, it's changed across the board. And I think that these younger drivers, I don't relate to these millennial drivers.
Why
because
not?
I'm Gen X.
He's getting old like you.
Defiantly Gen X. I don't understand them at all.
Those whippersnappers.
Yeah. I get that a lot, actually. I get the old – you sound like the old man telling people to get off his lawn.
But it's not just NASCAR that's doing this. The teams are doing it as well. Think about William Byron. He's driving a truck for Kyle Busch Motorsports last year, wins 7 times, darn near wins the championship. What happens? Rick Hendrick snaps him up. He's 19 years old. Yeah. He's what, second or third in the standings in the Xfinity Series right now? 19.
So we've talked about how the blue collar fans are maybe having a little financial difficulty in getting to the actual racetracks to see these things because it's expensive. And a lot of drivers are retiring or dropping out of the sport. But TV ratings dropped in 21 of 29 Cup races, and there's been a 45% dip in viewership on television since 2005, and TV is free. So when Dale Earnhardt says he's optimistic, or he sounds optimistic about the future of the sport, is that genuine? Is that pie in the sky? Or does he see something that these numbers aren't seeing?
Well, let me just say this about the TV part being free. It used to be it was on the main networks, you know,
you gotta,
ABC,
okay,
CBS, NBC.
Cable
now,
and
Nate can speak probably more to this than I can. You have NBCSN, which carries some races in a development where the networks are trying to use NASCAR, leverage that to promote these alternative networks that they want to use. Fox did the same thing as well. That has been something that you hear from fans a lot. I don't want that cable package. I have to buy all these other 20 channels to get that one channel that I want. Yeah.
The other thing I'm curious about is sponsorship, because I was doing a lot of reading yesterday about this, and evidently the sponsor on the hood of your car can help or hurt you. Monster drinks evidently are very attractive to younger people, and if you got Monster sponsoring your car, you're going to do okay. Is that the idea?
Well, that was the idea with NASCAR signing them as the title sponsor. They believe Monster energy drinks, which, by the way, again, I don't consume, but that younger generation does, and I trust that NASCAR believes in aligning with a company like that with this push of stars that were born 1990 and post that year. Will benefit them in terms of attracting an audience that, frankly, you know, the three of us might not be able to relate to. I'll make one more point on TV just real quick because that's my job. NBC Sports has a terrific streaming platform as well where we stream all of the races, practices, qualifying. And I think that if you look solely at ratings, that might be a little bit too tunnel visioned.
Yeah, because we have the same.
Exactly. MRN does the same.
Who consumes those streams? Obviously, you must know who consumes them. Is it the younger fans or is it the older fans as well?
I think definitely younger fans. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody uses a mobile device for everything in their lives these days.
Yeah, so you can access it wherever you are, whenever you want, as opposed to appointment viewing or appointment listening, like we all came up having along the way. But one more point about Monster. You know, they just produced their first 30-second television commercial. When we met the executives when they announced the deal at Las Vegas at the season-ending awards banquet, they are a different kind of beast in terms of marketing. They rely so much on the social media aspect of it and they don't do the traditional, you know, full-page newspaper ad, 30-second TV spot, 30-second radio spot. That's not how they built and how they grew. They have this energy, no pun intended, of making it the cool place to be and putting their logo all over it.
You know, a lot of other sports, including football, when they build new stadiums, et cetera, they build the stadium obviously for the game, but they also build it for the fan experience in mind. It's become about creating an environment that the fan wants to be in, and they may or may not watch the game, or they may, in this case, may or may not watch the race. Is that happening?
It's not happening fast enough. I think that's a huge growth area for tracks.
I'm really surprised to hear you guys say that. Yeah. You didn't say it. Nathan.
I'll say it. I mean, I've been covering races since 1998. I've covered more than 400 cup races, and I have not witnessed the changes I think racetracks need to make.
Like what?
To offer amenities.
What do they need to do?
Free Wi-Fi, first of all. Free and dependable Wi-Fi. If they are serious about attracting younger fans who spend all day on their smartphones and tweeting and Instagramming and Snapchatting, they need to get serious about getting a lot more Wi-Fi availability at tracks.
People want to be able to say, hey, look what I'm doing. Isn't this cool to their friends? Now, Daytona, with the Daytona Rising Project, did go a long way toward getting the Wi-Fi in. They're doing a multi-million dollar renovation project at Phoenix as well, and Wi-Fi was a big part of their presentation because they know their fans want that. They want to have that access.
That seems like a relatively inexpensive thing to do, isn't it?
But tracks are huge compared to a basketball arena. It's a little bit of a different
track. Tracks are also – there's a different structure, Mike, in that tracks are owned by public companies, whereas if you know the Hornets or the Panthers just want to take their stadium and retrofit it, it's different in NASCAR where you have International Speedway Corporation, Speedway Motorsports Incorporated, based in Charlotte, that both have several tracks under their purview. And when they make changes, they're doing it answering to shareholders and quarterly profits, and they're doing it with board approval. They're doing it in a completely different way than professional teams.
But that's in their best interest to do those things.
It is because they're publicly traded companies, yes.
So why wouldn't they be on the bandwagon? And maybe they are.
They're on the bandwagon, but I think that, you know, as you know, much more so than me doing this program, I mean, things I think tend to move at a more glacial pace when you're a publicly traded company versus
privately. So what else needs to be done? And what have you heard they're thinking about doing?
I think that they need to get more amenities in. I think they need to put seatbacks. And Woody mentioned Daytona Rising at Daytona National Speedway, $400 million renovation of a crown jewel of NASCAR that truly looks like a professional sports stadium.
And escalators at a racetrack.
Yeah, not enough racetracks look like that. Too many racetracks still have antiquated facilities.
Mm-hmm. So are we making this too sophisticated? I mean, are we deliberately pushing away the people who used to go to the dirt tracks and spend the Sunday afternoon in a cheap environment, in an inexpensive environment, and enjoying the race for the race?
I think there's a balance there. You have to satisfy your traditional fan base and keep them happy, while realizing that there's a whole new generation of younger fans coming along who expect to be able to hit up their phone whenever they want, to stream stuff whenever they want, wherever they are. There's a balancing act there that has to be struck.
Because today we have a very short attention span, particularly yes. younger people, and they are glued to their phones. And one thing can lead to another, and they may start by exploring something that is going on behind the scenes at the track on their phone. But then again, they might move on to something else, and the race is going on. And I was surprised to hear you say that this needs to happen, because I would have thought that for you guys, the sport is the sport. The sport is the attraction. It's the race, not all this peripheral stuff.
Oh, the race is definitely the core product, but there are ways to enhance it, and that's all they've been trying to do over the last 10 years. Another thing they're talking about, Mike, when you say short attention spans, I mean, they're looking at shortening races. This year,
They have.
They instituted something called stage points, which ensures that throughout the course of a race, drivers are racing harder than they have in the past. So they're cognizant of the fact that people have shorter attention spans and they need to keep them interested.
It takes 4 hours, doesn't it, to drive 500 miles?
Yeah.
So are we looking at the Coca-Cola 10-miler?
I think there are some iconic ones that you won't see change, like the 600. But yeah, they shortened the races at Pocono and Dover.
Right.
And by all accounts, that was well-received in the racing community and among fans.
Is this slump, if it's a slump, and I'm not sure it is. You tell me if it is. Is it a phase? Is it just something they have to work through, because everything goes through ebbs and valves? Mm-hmm.
We always hear that in racing, that everything is cyclical, from performance to sponsorship to drivers. Everything changes. But I think that NASCAR is facing challenges now like it never has before, like any industry in America, as you mentioned, Mike. And I think that they need to be serious, and I think they are, for the most part, and addressing them and getting aggressive with it. And you know, you mentioned the grassroots side of things. A great example there, Kyle Larson, who to me, Woody, is the greatest of these new young drivers. He's the points leader. He's got a victory. He is really aggressive about running grassroots races, the short dirt track races that you referred to, Mike. And I think if you have that kind of balance, if you have a focus on 21st century NASCAR, but also have your young stars racing on Saturday nights or Wednesday nights at a dirt track near Charlotte, that's going
to
help.
Yeah, like if one of the Hornets went to a local gym, a high school gym, and hung out and played some pickup ball with the guys, you know, that type of thing.
So what do you think the problem is with the NASCAR Hall of Fame?
There's a loaded question if I've ever heard one.
If you've been to some of the others, I think it's the most interactive, the most technologically driven compared to any of them.
It's actually fun to be there.
It's a really cool place, but I think it's like anything else. It takes time to build. There's not a switch. I understand it's been here a while, but there's not a switch you can throw that's gonna make that suddenly be, you know, the greatest thing on the planet.
It's been there for 7 years.
Yeah.
I have an opinion on this from a historical perspective. I used to work at the Richmond newspaper, and Richmond was bidding for the NASCAR Hall of Fame with about 8 other cities at one point.
Right.
And because all the cities were trying to, you know, get this great grand prize, there were some really inflated projections in terms of revenues, in terms of admissions. And I feel like the NASCAR Hall of Fame is a very good place to go. Like Woody said, very interactive, very technological. But I feel like it's still suffering from the weight of all of the things that were promised, not just by Charlotte, but by Richmond, Atlanta, Daytona, all the cities that bid and really created
built up the expectations.
Well, it looks nice.
It does.
So in your view, what is the most promising thing going on either in front of the fans or behind the scenes that bodes well for the future of racing?
I think stage points.
Yeah.
I think that NASCAR has created a new way of, you know, forcing drivers and teams to race hard. It's created new strategies. It has added wrinkles and dramatic elements during the courses of races this year. It's too complicated, I think, to explain in the short time we have left. But I think that it's simplistic in a way, and that it's just about getting guys to race harder throughout the course of a race. And I think that's been
Instead of just making it to the end, you have to get to the end in order to win. But now they're racing for something during. It's like quarters in football or basketball.
Right.
The other thing to build on what Nate said is the young stars that we've been talking about. These are dynamic young guys that people will gravitate to if they win.
Okay. And how will they win? Well, because the old guys will get out.
Well, they're starting
somebody
to win
has
anyway.
To win.
Yeah.
Woody Kane is radio news director for the Motor Racing Network and the host of NASCAR Today. And Nate Ryan is a NASCAR reporter for NBC Sports. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks
Mike. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, even as NASCAR contemplates entering a new era, you as an internet user should too. The FCC is contemplating rolling back one of the Obama administration's signature policies, net neutrality. Despite most people's daily use of the internet, they may not know much about the impact of ending that policy. Net neutrality regulations are meant to guarantee open, equal access to the internet. And without those regulations, you may find your internet speed slowing down or paying more if you are a heavy user. It's a little more complicated than that. So we've invited some experts to explain it and talk about the implications of such a rollback. Brian Fung is a technology reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us by phone. And Dr. John MacArthur is associate professor in the Knight School of Communication at Queen's University of Charlotte. He's in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome to you both. Brian, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. John MacArthur, welcome to you.
Good morning.
To see you again. First, for those of whom may not know what we're talking about, a real quick definition, Brian, of net neutrality.
Sure. Net neutrality is essentially an idea about fairness on the internet. The concept essentially says internet providers shouldn't be allowed to block websites from getting to you or to slow them down or to charge folks who own websites or operate websites extra fees in order for their content to be displayed on your, you know, phone or your tablet or your computer. So ultimately, you know, this is a concept that has mostly been recognized as an informal kind of principle up until now. And the Federal Communications Commission in 2015 passed these rules enshrining these principles into regulation, which industry folks say, you know, is overbroad and, you know, is an example of government overreach. And so this battle we're seeing right now is over whether or not these regulations will stand.
So having net neutrality, Dr. MacArthur, what has that meant to me as an internet user?
Well, every communication transaction that takes place has a sender and a receiver. Mm-hmm. When we do that over the internet, when you request information to your computer from some other source, it flows through a network that is governed by the internet service provider, the company that you pay money to provide internet service. Now, under net neutrality, the concept of net neutrality, the internet service provider would not have any means of slowing down or changing the rate of access to information. However, if there are no rules, opponents of net neutrality argue that the consumers will have to advocate for themselves to have the internet speeds and the information that they need come through the internet service provider in a way that is equitable.
My head's going to explode. So what has this done to internet service providers, Brian? I mean, the fact that we have a neutral net network, what's that done to them?
Well, internet providers argue that the rules have caused them to invest less in their networks, you know, upgrading speeds or building out to other unserved areas at a rate that's slower than they otherwise would have without the rules. And you know, there's a big kind of political debate about how you count that or how you measure that. But the argument from industry is that you know, this has sort of depressed investment, and that rolling back the rules will, you know, create jobs and increase investment. You know, consumer advocates say, you know, the investment has continued despite the rules going into effect. And, you know, you've seen companies like AT&T and Verizon, you know, continue to increase their speeds. In fact, Verizon last month said, you know, they're going to roll out a gigabit service.
Let me stop you there, Brian, because I have to take a break. We'll come back and finish on the other side of the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Clayworks, a Charlotte home for ceramic arts and artists, offering registration now for spring adult classes and children's summer camps. Details at learnclay.com. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. Healthcare costs have long been a point of contention, and experts say one seldom talked about factor could go a long way toward reducing costs, wasteful spending. One estimate says the healthcare system squanders more than $750 billion every year, more than the entire budget of the Pentagon. So in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point, They'll take a look at that and get an update on Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. That's all upcoming. We will continue our conversation about net neutrality in a moment. Stay with us.
The U.S. and allies in Asia are worried about North Korea's nuclear program. So this week, the U.S. deployed an advanced anti-missile system in South Korea. But it's not so popular with some South Koreans. I'm Robert Siegel. How the THAAD missile defense system works and how it's creating new problems with China. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about net neutrality and the Trump administration's FCC thinking about rolling back the Obama order that created net neutrality or enshrined it in policy. Brian Fung is with us. He's a technology reporter for The Washington Post. Dr. John Alexander is associate professor at the Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte. So, Brian, I had interrupted you before the break, and you were talking about Verizon and announcing their new speeds, etc.
Yeah, so Verizon had recently announced that they were going to start rolling out a new service that can reach up to a gigabit of download speeds. That's roughly 1,000 megabits per second, where most homes today get, roughly 10 to 17 megabits per second downloads. Internet providers have gradually been rolling out faster and faster speeds, even though they've been complaining that these rules are suppressing their investment in their networks.
So who's telling the truth here then?
The idea here is that this issue has a philosophical underpinning that says information should be equal for everyone.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Why was the Obama administration, why did they decide that net neutrality is a good thing, and why is the new FCC director deciding that it's not a good thing? Is it just a philosophical difference, a difference between Republicans and Democrats? What is this?
Well, with all great philosophical differences come economic and political differences. And so the philosophical similarity is that most of the Republicans and Democrats probably agree that information should be equal. However, we don't agree about how to regulate it. So do we provide regulations, as the Obama administration did, that would guarantee that internet service providers would have equal access to have equal provision of information to consumers? Or do we let the marketplace demands of the consumer weigh in to that discussion?
Brian, you wrote, I believe, that the Obama administration's classifying of internet service providers, ISPs, as common carriers allowed the government the power to ban certain practices like the outright blocking of internet traffic. But let's talk about common carriers for just a couple of seconds. I'm old enough to remember that you didn't make a long-distance phone call because it was just too expensive, period. And then I remember cell phones when they first came out. You paid for minutes. You don't pay for minutes. Most people don't pay for minutes anymore. They just pay for a thing, and you can get long-distance free. Under the absence of net neutrality, are we going on the internet back to that world where we have to worry about our minutes or our data flow? Isn't that going backwards in some ways?
Well, in order to understand what's going on here, you really have to talk about the way that the internet providers' business models have changed. And you were just talking about how you no longer buy minutes anymore. Well, the cost of providing internet access and getting internet access, that's gone lower and lower over time, which means less and less money for internet providers. And so the idea that internet access has become commodified is forcing internet providers to look elsewhere for ways to make money. And this is where you get internet providers trying to charge you for your privacy or trying to charge other websites for access to regular consumers. They're looking for ways to bolster their bottom line in an era where internet access has become commodified.
So right now, if I choose the speed that I want to pay for, and if I do a lot of streaming, I would choose a higher speed because you can't stream Netflix on a slow connection. It's just not going to work very well. So I make that decision. What can I afford? What do I want? Under net neutrality, if you remove net neutrality, how does that affect me? If you're just a guy who checks his email every day and maybe surfs to buy something on Amazon, are you going to be affected whether or not there is net neutrality? And if you're somebody who streams a lot, are you going to be more affected if this goes away?
essentially, this puts the power in the hands of the internet provider to decide what types of traffic will be favored in terms of speed and what types of services will be disadvantaged. So, you know, you could have an internet provider potentially decide to slow down your Netflix at the expense, or I'm sorry, at the benefit of email or other less data-intensive applications, which would be arguably to your detriment. But, you know, the internet providers would say, oh, you have a choice. If you don't like us, you can go somewhere else. Unfortunately, for many consumers in America, they only have one or two choices. So if all of the internet providers in your market have decided to do this, then you're kind of out of luck.
Would that be would internet service providers deliberately slow down Netflix or Hulu or Facebook or Google because the traffic on it is so high? Or would you have to pay more to them for them to take the brakes off?
In the recent Supreme Court case, the representative for Verizon said that were there no regulations, the company would probably look to making financial partnerships with Netflix or other streaming services to increase speed to those services that were willing to partner with the service provider. So the answer is it would depend on your service provider and their partnerships financially.
This sounds like a way to make more money.
It is.
In every way.
For an internet service provider.
Because either you charge your consumer or you charge the major internet sites that are using a lot of data, or both. And even if you charge, if you just charge Netflix, it's going to cost more to use Netflix. They're going to pass it on to you, right, Brian?
And what makes this tricky is that these contracts between companies are not transparent. You don't have any access into, there's no visibility into the terms of these agreements. So you don't know what Netflix is paying. You don't know, what Comcast may be receiving. You don't even know, whether the terms are favorable for Netflix or favorable for Comcast. So this lack of transparency means that if Netflix decides to increase your costs, how much of that is due to these agreements? You don't even have access into that type of information.
So is this like cable television all over again?
Any provision of utility, right? A cable TV, a phone service, a radio broadcast. These things are all governed by the Federal Communications Commission. The difference is with the cable service, generally that's a monopoly for most people. You have maybe two options for cable service, and internet service providers are the same way. So the question for the Communications Commission, Federal Communications Commission, is whether or not this is a communications outlet or whether or not this is an economic monopoly that needs to be addressed.
Well, the FCC chairman says that the previous administration's stand on net neutrality was pure politics, and that the more heavily you regulate something, the less you're likely to get. Brian, do you think that's been true in this case?
Well, I think that the messaging around net neutrality has been very politically driven. There's certainly folks on the conservative side who say, the greater regulation of internet may lead to less of that good. But certainly, folks on the other side say, actually, in order to have more of the kinds of innovation in internet that we want, there have to be some rules of the road. And, where you fall on that debate, I think, depends on your existing ideology.
Services like Netflix and Vimeo and others fear that the removal of net neutrality could result in their services being slowed down, which we've talked a little bit about here, particularly if the internet service provider has a similar service of its own that it wants to push to you. Is that likely to happen? And how many ISPs have a service like Netflix at their fingertips?
Well, you see service providers, you see media conglomerates buying up all sorts of things. So when you think about Time Warner, it's got a whole slew of things that are underneath it that it may privilege those items in these financial partnerships. So the question for us becomes, if we are, in the Knight School of Communication, we're thinking about how do we get people access to the internet? The net neutrality debate is about once we have access to the internet, how do we access information broadly, and what does an internet service provider's role in providing that information to the consumer? What role do they have in shaping the way that information flows to the average person who's out on the street trying to get information.
So there's another concern that I read about, that this could result in a pay-to-use fast lane for distributing certain products that use a lot of data. Consumers already pay for a certain level of speed. Why would it be a bad thing for websites or streaming services to have to pay to be on the fast lane, Ryan?
Well, the argument here is that, you know, internet providers occupy a very strategic position. They control access to consumers, and they control access to websites. The idea here is that, you know, by setting up these kind of exclusive relationships or, you know, segmenting the internet in certain ways, they can actually control what an internet user actually sees on the internet or what is available to them. And by definition, that would kind of tilt the marketplace and favor some businesses over others and, you know, help sort of determine how the internet ecosystem evolves. So you would essentially be putting a thumb on that scale, allowing internet providers to pick winners and losers. So perhaps the next Netflix or the next Google might not have a chance to succeed against the existing Google or the existing Netflix.
So I understand that, is it Ajit Pai, is that how you say his name, the FCC chairman? I understand that prior to this, he worked for a while for Verizon, I believe. So is the pressure for this coming from the Verizons and the Comcasts and the Spectrums of the world?
I think they're definitely on the other side of it. Chairman Pai, he was a commissioner at the FCC when the new regulations were in place, and he dissented then. So it's no surprise that he's dissenting now. But the internet service providers are on the other side of this debate, saying, well, you know, if we don't provide service in the way that is best for the consumer, then the consumers obviously aren't going to buy our services. Mm-hmm. And there's a debate about whether that is actually the case.
Some fear that ISPs and wireless providers might take to censoring what you can see on the internet in the absence of net neutrality. What would be their motivation for censoring what you can see, Brian?
Well, I think censoring may be putting it a little strongly. I think, you know, what we might be more likely to see is sort of some of that unintentional filtering or perhaps, you know, the unintended consequences of that filtering being more likely. So, you know, if AT&T moves to favor its own proprietary video streaming service, you know, over other competing streaming services, then maybe, you know, you might see fewer channels on your internet streaming TV service than you might otherwise be able to get, for example. And all of this sort of goes back to this idea that, you know, if you're an internet user, your choices or your, you know, the range of content you can access is being powerfully shaped by your internet provider.
I love the term that a lot of our journalist friends are using, like Brian, that is called throttling. The idea is that information isn't necessarily censored, but that some information will be throttled or choked off so that it moves slower, so that you would be less likely to access that information. And this throttling is the real concern in the access world.
Yeah, because I'll wait about 3 seconds, and then I'm done.
Yeah, switch to another one.
I'm moving on. Yeah. Just after the FCC announced its plan to end net neutrality, the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., refused to rehear an earlier case, which I'm told sets this up as a possible case for the Supreme Court. Is it liable to get that far, Brian?
Well, certainly a lot of people who watch the Supreme Court say it could get that far. You know, I spoke to one of the petitioners, one of the people who are actually in the case suing the FCC, and he said he intends to appeal to the Supreme Court. Now, whether or not the court actually takes up the case is another matter. Currently, you know, the FCC is about to unveil this rulemaking process that would seek to undo the FCC's net neutrality rules. And so it's possible the Supreme Court would say, you know, the FCC's already got this thing going on. Let's hold off until anything, you know, until that process sorts itself out.
And some want Congress to take this up and pass a law that would settle this once and for all and overrule the FCC. Is that likely to happen? And if it were to happen, wouldn't it mirror what the FCC chairman wants to do because it's a Republican Congress?
our lovely system of checks and balances, right? We have the FCC, we have Congress, we have the courts, and they all get to weigh in. So depending on what is actually put into place, one branch or the other can come in and have their say too.
And Brian, you mentioned something. You said the magic word privacy a few minutes ago, and some fear that the repeal of net neutrality not only will drive up consumer costs, but it will allow ISPs to start charging for things, extra things, including not selling your private information to advertisers or whomever. You could pay extra and they'll keep that private. Seems like extortion to me, but okay. But President Trump has already signed legislation repealing privacy protections for internet users. So does that remove the concern with regard to net neutrality?
Well, the privacy rules that President Trump signed to repeal a few weeks ago, those rules actually depended on net neutrality for their legal authority. And so, those rules were only, they only came into being because the FCC had passed its net neutrality rules. And now that those rules have been repealed, that the privacy rules have been repealed, internet providers are now free to do things like charge you for privacy or to mine your data and sell it to third-party marketers or advertisers. And this goes back to their interest in building new business models. Not only do they want to sell you internet access or sell you TV shows, but now also to watch how you behave online and then market that, sell targeted ads and whatnot.
But the FCC chairman says the end of net neutrality will result in the creation of more jobs, greater user privacy, and innovation. So who's right?
Yeah, so the basis for that argument is that the FCC wants to return jurisdiction for regulating internet providers back to the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. Mm-hmm. And the Federal Trade Commission, regulates companies like Google and Netflix and Facebook for their privacy statements, their privacy policies. And when those policies get violated, then the FTC has the power to come in and say you did a bad thing. The argument here is that, internet providers should have to live under that regime and not some sort of rules that the FCC puts in place.
Brian Fung is a technology reporter for The Washington Post. Dr. John MacArthur is associate professor in the Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte. We'll keep following this. Thanks for